Today on CyberWork, my guest is Dirk Schrader of NewNet Technologies, and our conversation is around healthcare security and legacy systems. We discuss the millions of pieces of health data left out in the open, the issues with closing these holes, and the need for professional legacy system whisperers. That's all today on CyberWork. Also, I want to tell you about CyberWork Applied, a new series from CyberWork. Whether you want to learn about how cross-site scripting attacks work, set up a man-in-the-middle attack, or get a blow-by-blow recap of the Equifax breach, expert InfoSec instructors and industry practitioners will teach these cybersecurity skills and show you how these skills apply to real-world scenarios. Best of all, it's 100% free. Just go to infosecinstitute.com/learn or check out the link in the description below and get started with fun hands-on training that keeps the cybersecurity skills you have relevant. That's infosecinstitute.com/learn. And now, let's begin the show. Welcome to this week's episode of the CyberWork with InfoSec podcast. Each week, we talk with a different industry thought leader about cybersecurity skills, the way those skills affect, the way trends affect the work of InfoSec professionals, and offer tips for breaking in or moving up the ladder in the cybersecurity industry. Dirk Schrader is the Global VP of NewNet Technology, or NNT. A native of Germany, Dirk's work focuses on advancing cyber resilience as a sophisticated new approach to tackle cyber attacks faced by governments and organizations of all sizes, for the handling of change and vulnerability as the two main issues to address in information security. Dirk has worked on cybersecurity projects around the globe, including more than 4 years in Dubai. He has published numerous articles in German and English about the need to address change and vulnerability to achieve cyber resilience, drawing on his experience and certification as a CISSP, ISC squared, and CISM, ISACA. His recent work includes research in the area of medical devices, where he found hundreds of systems unprotected in the public internet, allowing access to sensitive patient data. So this is going to be the topic of today's episode, and we're going to talk about unprotected or poorly protected legacy systems in general, and how we start to build some coverage over this vast swath of unprotected information. Dirk, welcome to CyberWork.
Thank you, Chris. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. So we always like to start out informally with an origin story question first. What was your initial attraction to computers and security? And I looked at your bio, and it seems that you've been a fan of computers and tech for a long time, and that even your first job out of university was for Commodore, which was my first home computer.
Really? So what, which yeah. one you had?
Commodore 64. Yep, way back in the day.
Oh, come on, me too.
Yeah. That's where I can always sort of gauge an age range of guests when we all say, oh, yeah, Commodore 64, first computer. I'm like, okay, we're about the same age. So what was it that drew you to security as a career and a passion?
Well, to cut a long, boring story short, I guess, it actually started with my dad. Okay. Simple as that. Yeah. So he was an electrical engineer in a steel factory, working on high voltage systems there, anything across higher than 15,000 volts. Yeah, you don't touch it, at least only once. And then in the same way, he was also a farmer. So I grew up on a farm. I grew up with electricity systems, with electrical appliances and machinery. And he was always taking me to help him fixing things or improving things which were about to go broke. And from that on, it was a path, let's say.
Yeah.
Someone in one of my previous bosses, a mentor, better to say, introduced me to networking. Then I was diving into security, did my, which is not mentioned in my bio because it has expired, I did my Cisco Certified Security Professional. And finally, I got into what I'm doing right now, which is security is a process. So the CISSP, CISM, and that's my main fashion, I have to say. And to be fair, it wasn't always that direct way as it sounds now. I have tried, put it that way, myself in other aspects of information technology as well. Well, but anyway, the last 20 years, yes, it was always about information security.
Okay. Yeah. And I'm wondering if just the notion of like electrical grids and sort of like home wiring and stuff, did that sort of train your brain in general for the idea of like computer networks and this idea of sort of like all these sort of connected systems together? Because it seems like there's like a real sort of natural progression there in terms of like this is connected to this, and when this goes out, this whole thing goes out and all that.
My it definitely does. And one of these earliest stories I have with my dad in terms of what do you want to do with your professional life was that he was taking me with him to his steel factory, and he was asking me to join a group of apprentices they had there. And the trainer for these apprentices, they gave me all their old, where is mine? Yeah, all of these old calculators.
Oh, yes.
Not that old.
Sure, sure.
To unmantle them and to clean them. And then I was looking at these chips and the board and these microprocessors and all like that. I want to know what that is.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a whole different kind of maze. That's really interesting.
Yeah.
So yeah, you said that, you know, you've tried many things and you wound up in information security. And I wanted to sort of point out that I looked at your LinkedIn bio, and I noticed that you've worked in different aspects of the security industry, from sales to marketing up to your current position in research. Can you talk about some of these stepping stone moments and sort of figuring out what worked and what didn't and what you were passionate about and what made you sort of make these big jumps to higher levels and you know, because I think a lot of people, you know, it's easy to get stuck in a position and say, well, I'm good at this, I might as well keep doing it. So like, were there moments where you got home from work one day and you're just like, I can't do this anymore, I gotta try this next thing? And if so, how did you sort of get yourself unstuck into doing things that you really love?
Well, two things. First, there's nothing bad in it to say I love it, I stay where I am. And there's also nothing bad in it to realize, although I never had that precise moment to say, no, I can't do that anymore. For me, it was next to the one thing I just mentioned, which is about the mentor of mine who introduced me to networking, there were a few things, a few moments and individuals. One of the things is working in international teams, like in the Commodore European Support Council, where the colleagues there, among other things, took away my fear of talking in English.
Yeah, I mean, right.
Yeah, come on. if you see my school grades in English lessons, that's a different thing.
Right.
And in the same way, when I was living in Dubai, where I worked for Siemens, it was also that notion of improve yourself and get you to the point of, can I go deeper? Can I dig deeper? Can I have a better understanding of, and coming to sales and marketing here, is that what I'm selling, what I'm talking about, what I'm marketing, is, do I understand that well enough so that my explanation about it, the way I'm telling it to customers in terms of this is what it does, this is a brochure, or trying to convince them about the value proposition of a product, of a solution, of a service, is there. So, yeah, sales and marketing is not bad. There are good positions. But it was something where I realized that, hey, digging deeper, trying to understand, trying to get behind the inner workings of something is surely a mindset that not only I do share with my colleagues here at NNT, it is also something where, how to say that, I have that opportunity in the current role, and which is, when you look at cybersecurity from a connector's point of view, everybody is affected by cybersecurity in one sense or the other. And that is the opportunity to work with people from various backgrounds, from various regions. And that in itself is the biggest stepping stone moment for me. Every day, I can listen, I can learn, I can share thoughts.
Yeah.
Like we do it right now. That's the best part in my job, I have to admit.
Yeah. Yeah. Your world is opening up constantly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So so let's talk about your current job here. What is your work day like as a security research manager? How do you prepare for a day? Do you have a to-do list at the beginning of the day? Does it go up in smoke around 10 a.m. or
Lots of coffee.
No. Lots of coffee. We're all living on that.
No, I think I'm not special in this. Anyone in cybersecurity has lots of things to read. That's a lot things to digest,
right?
To stay on top of current developments, to get familiar with new TTPs, techniques, procedures, attack vectors. So, yeah, I think it's needless to say that a lot of reading, it takes a good part of my day.
Right.
I'm not so much into emergency handling. I have to admit, sort of, I do admire the guys who do that on that constant challenge, on that constant notion of, if I make a mistake here, the things go really broke. But for me, it's something where I am probably in the earlier stages of that process of these phases, right, where I'm talking about prevention, about being resilient.
Right.
And you mentioned it in the intro. Cyber resilience is my favorite, and it's about being prepared for an attack, being able to maintain operation while being attacked, learn from the attack, come out of that incident, of that attack, of that dip in your punch you get, coming out of that as a matured organization. And cyber resilience in that part is different to business continuity or disaster recovery, as it addresses the organization at a different, much more encompassing level.
Yeah.
And then how do organizations evolve to be cyber resilient? How to mature in that? How to maintain a high level? This notion of maintaining a high level, what forms a major part of my work? How to adjust to attacks like, take an example, the SolarWinds thing, or even to envisage, to foresee new TTPs, not yet seen. As an example, for things being in discussion right now in during my work with the team, what's the consequence of digitalization for operational technology? How does that shift or change priorities from away from availability, which is the major sort of priority they're currently operating in when they are not fully digitalized or out of, let's say, context in terms of what they have learned in the past 20 years. When you think of that as the paramount of their deterministic processes in production environments, what is the impact of that digitalization? And that's some of the things we're working on. Not so much fancy and very high-techy sometimes, but I do consider that a good piece of groundwork and to connect between those hardcore, might be a wrong word of saying that, those well-versed hackers and the folks doing the business processes, the folks doing the operations. If you don't combine these two worlds, then you will never be resilient.
Yeah. And I think that's really important to sort of separate out the work of handling the immediate problems versus handling the work of future proofing, or, you know, as you say, sort of like figuring out the next steps of the hardcore hackers of the future, and knowing that if your business is only dedicated to sort of like quashing the immediate fires, you're never going to be ready for the next sort of way. Everything is always going to be on the defensive if you don't have someone there sort of planning in the offense. So, you know, and I think that's going to be useful for our listeners to hear in terms of thinking about, you know, because we're always trying to figure out, you know, what do you want to do with your life? You know, do you want to be putting out the fires now, or do you want to be, as you say, getting up every day, reading about the, you know, the new TTPs and figuring out new you know, angles, and you're almost kind of playing like a long chess with the hackers in that regard, I guess. You're thinking what they could possibly be doing in the future. Okay, so a few months ago we had on Emily Miller of Mocana, who spent her career defending nationwide infrastructures and IoT against hacks and invasions. And we discussed the case in Oldsmar, Florida, which I know you've been following as well, in which a hacker tried to poison the town's water supply by adjusting lye levels. So our topic today is legacy systems, in part, in healthcare, which covers a lot of ground. But one place we are going to settle on is the topic of unprotected healthcare records, as it's the issue that's surprisingly open and which, you know, to hear you tell it, is acknowledged and also sort of ignored by many healthcare providers. So I want to have you just sort of give us the top down about your report and your findings on the state of healthcare record security right now.
Well, the origins of that report go back almost 2 years. Mm-hmm. When I was reading a story about a researcher who had talked about a proof of concept that he was able to manipulate medical imagery so that he could take cancer away from the images, or he could make cancer appear on the images. Which, if you think of medical imagery as a part of the medical process, you go for an X-ray, you go for a CT, and then you have your images taken, and then they are presented to the doctor to actually sort of derive your treatment. And once that underlying source of information, the image itself, is lost, is manipulated, then we are in danger. So I was like, is that, how big of an issue is that? I mean, I was going in there with the assumption, okay, yeah, you need to be next to the device, you need to be within the network, you need to have overcome certain hurdles like firewalls, like whatever. And I was like, okay, let me check that. So it was actually an evening here in Germany, and I went online and searched for some background, and was sort of checking which kind of parameters do I have to look for. And so just about 5 minutes later, I had a system unprotected, connected to the network. I was able to see the patient data. I was able to see the images. I was I could have downloaded the whole data set, and that was about 18,000 studies on that device. And there was no protection at all. There was no encryption, no firewall, no passwords, no multi-factor authentication, a plain server connected to the internet with everything on it. And for me, it was shockingly simple to find one.
Yeah.
That initial system, which sort of started the whole process, that was a system in the UK. And in with the details of the data, a Whois search of the IP address, related SSL certs, I was able to reach out to the administrators of that system via LinkedIn. And in a matter of days, that system went off the grid. You can imagine that I was curious.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we started to search. Shodan is a big help, yes. Mm-hmm. And a few months later, at the end of the first round of searching and data collection, we had hundreds of systems where, in our data set, where we had access to unprotected access. We had from all over the place, all over the world, every continent except Antarctica. Would be interesting if there is one. And the amount of studies we've finally had in our data collection in terms of our statistics, we didn't download anyone, were hundreds of millions of studies from patients across the globe, billions of images related to them, details, 3D imagery, scary thing. I mean, if think of my own head in a CT in an MRT, and then someone else is able to actually get your head out of a medical archive, put it into a 3D printer, and then you can do a passport photo or whatever. Might not be true, but anyway.
You also mentioned that they using sort of graphic technologies that they'd be able to sort of add or remove cancer as well. I mean, and that's a horrendous thought that you could change someone's diagnosis, either like put a scare into them or make them go through chemo for nothing.
There was additional ways of having access to these devices. Mm-hmm. Some of them were actually so negligent that they were putting these devices not only into the DICOM protocol, which was my original research, they also had these devices connected using a web interface. Again, no password, no encryption, nothing, plus the option to upload files. Mm-hmm. Well, I left a note on some of the systems like saying, hey, you're open.
You're as open can be.
Yes, it is. So yeah. When we published the report, the outcry was massive.
Yeah.
I mean, it ended up, for example, in Malaysia that the government's health minister actually summoned an urgent meeting to follow up on each single system we found in that country, mm-hmm. which was funny in terms of reading the newspaper from Malaysia about these meetings.
Yeah. Anyway, busy day.
I was scared by the massive amount of findings. So I had, at the same time we were publishing the report, we were also reaching out to the German Federal Office for Information Security, because these guys are well connected. They have their peers in the world, the US CERT, the NCSC in the UK, ANSI as the French organization, and in most of the countries, and there were some 50 plus countries we actually had in our findings, they had a connection, they had a peer, so they could help us to give our findings to them to follow up on. And I was hoping that these authorities in the world would be able to identify the system owners and get the systems away from public view. And in the same way, I tried myself as best as I could to reach out to them. But yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, you noted in the report that you sent disclosure notices to the administrators of over 120 unprotected systems in the U.S. and that 69 administrators completely ignored the warnings. And you said that, you know, the response from Europe and the UK has been positive and that has been secured, you know, but other unprotected systems exist in Australia and Canada and one in France. And you concluded that the figures you gave to Security Week for the report relate entirely to the US, and rather than exposed systems being removed, new systems are still being added without adequate or any authentication requirements. So what's the reticence here? Why are administrators ignoring this warning? And, you know, so is there a sense that it's just too difficult to make these changes, or that maybe making these changes sort of implicates their prior negligence, or what do you think? Do they just seem to think it's not that big of a deal?
Well, in some cases, I would call it resistance.
Yeah.
And
sort of a don't tell me what to do sort of mindset, or?
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Just a few weeks ago, I was talking to an admin of one of the systems identified in the first round. So 18 months ago, or even 24 months ago. That system, a quite large one, is short over 500,000 studies on it, social security number, COVID diagnosis on it, and it was still online, unprotected after 18 months. So let's say from the time of doing the first round of reportings, informing the authorities, 18 months later, it was still there. So I tried again to reach out to speak to someone. And finally, I got connected to an admin. And he was like, yeah, I think I recall that message. And then now I do understand why the FBI was also trying to contact me.
FBI.
Got it. Come on.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I think it is.
More coffee needed.
Yeah. Sometimes. Yeah. Or something stronger. Mm-hmm. But for them, it was the way they communicate with their doctors. I can't take it behind a firewall. There was sort of that notion, and there were operational obstacles for me. So it is a reticence, a negligence on the one hand side, but also a felt need to do it that way. Yes. And yeah.
And my listeners are sick of hearing me say this, but one of my first job here in Chicago was I was I worked for the Chicago Medical Society. So I've worked with doctors a lot. And this was about 1999 till about 2005 or so. And this was right at that point where doctors were going from very, very old computer systems to slightly older old computer systems. And I can tell you that that reticence, the way I compare it is, like, as you said, like, you are completely embedded at all times in researching future threats, future this, future hacker, you know, vectors and whatever. Doctors are completely obsessed with their one thing, the vascular surgery, the veins, the brain. And it's unfortunately to the detriment of everything else. Like, when you would have like a conference, like, you would almost have to put their pen in their hands to get them to sign in, because they're thinking about that one thing. And it's a real problem, because obviously this is incredibly sensitive data. And as you said, there's this real problem with making the computer system too hard, because Dr. So-and-so doesn't want to deal with two-factor and look at their phone or put their thumbprint or whatever. So I don't know. Do you have any sort of thoughts in sort of getting around that?
Well, not really, because on the one hand side, if I would be sick and I would be in the need of a doctor who is really focused, I would love to have one.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. On the other hand, it explains why we are seeing that again and again. I mean, and anytime we generate a new base data set, we find fresh systems. And that's the weird thing. They haven't been there before, or even worse, they are old systems now with new IP addresses. When I look at the data itself, I can see, I have seen this names before. Sometimes it seems to me that they're trying to get away by moving to a new location.
You're moving, moving to a new address, but you still haven't taken your name out of the phone book.
It's still IP. Welcome to the world.
Yep.
And then, but the story told me that was told to me by that admin is only a part of it. Most of the folks we contacted, and when they didn't react, they are likely confused or overwhelmed.
Yeah.
I mean, they have no clue how the system works. Moving to a new location.
Right.
And that how things are connected to the public internet, how easy they are connected to the public internet, and how easy it is to overlook default configurations. And in a later round of connection attempts, one even told me that they regarded the initial disclosure, the one I was sending in December 19 and January 20, that they regarded that as a phishing attempt. So there is uncertainty, there is fear, there is lack of knowledge in that space. And overall, this is in great parts driven by two things. A, lack of enforcement.
Yep.
Sorry, HIPAA, toothless.
Yes.
Simple as it is. Organizations have plenty of time to report about a breach. And if they do so, it is somewhat blurry how much they report. I mean, I have a systems that have 1.2 million, I think if I do recall it correctly, I had a system that had 1.2 million studies on it. On average, that would require would represent about, let's say, one in six, 200,000 citizens.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm not mistaken, they've reported 10,000 people affected by it. So there's that not well-defined structure of when do you have to report, how do you have to report, and how is it enforced, and what happens to you if you don't do it. Maybe CCPA and the other privacy regulations coming up in the country will be more efficient here. Let's see. In here in Europe, GDPR can bite you.
Yeah, that's got teeth. That has teeth.
Yeah.
I mean, I know about HIPAA, it seems like it's still kind of focused on just physical issues of, you know, sort of like health in, you know, actual physical health. You know, there's regulations for, sterilizing or having your, you know, your operating room just so. But like, I don't, it doesn't seem like HIPAA ever really caught up to security as sort of like a key component of like effective healthcare. I don't know. I could be wrong on that, but I agree with you.
I read it, I feel like, yeah, basic. Okay.
Right. Bare minimum. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. The second part for me is next to that lack of understanding how the technology in itself works. What does it mean? Is the lack of understanding what is the consequences? What is the potential fallout? So they don't get it that someone can do very bad things with a name, a date of birth, a social security number, and a location.
Yes.
So if I have access to data from an elderly person which is residing in a nursing home, I have the date of birth, I have the social security number, and then I just have to read the, I think yesterday it was published, or the day before, the story of Brian Krebs about the ways of how easy it is to unlock someone's credit freeze. And put these things together. I mean, there are systems in where the archives are operated for years and years. I mean, we found data going back to the early 90s when I started my work at Commodore that holds massive amount of data. And that system I mentioned with the 1.2 million studies, that included social security numbers. When you know the name of the system operator, you can go into a certain region, and then there is a lot of public knowledge you can use. And I was actually doing that for my own kind of test of a research. I took a couple of names. I took the social security numbers, Facebook is your best friend when you're trying to investigate someone. I was able to find phone numbers. I was able to find addresses, and then here I am. Well,
here you are.
Well prepared to do ID theft.
And
all started with having an unprotected medical archive.
Yep. Now, I'm trying to
Have to call me before I'm going on a rant here.
No, I was saying I'm trying to give them the benefit of the doubt. I understand that money and budgets are always a factor, but what are some of the logistical issues in implementing mass security upgrades for healthcare infrastructure? Is there an issue of like massive upgrades taking systems offline for an extended period? Like, again, I keep coming back to what is the reticence, but like, apart from not believing the threat or not seeing it, like, is there that issue? Because, you know, I think like with most sort of critical, you know, things like healthcare, like even taking your system offline for an hour can be a big problem if people are in surgery or what have you. So is there a way of doing this that would be kind of minimally disruptive, or is that just have to be part of it?
An easy way of or a simplistic way of answering the questions would be to say compliance stands in the way of compliance.
Okay.
So you have your healthcare device. In order to be allowed to operate a healthcare device in a hospital's environment, it has to pass certain certifications. It's safe to operate things. It doesn't harm people when operated, and all these things. And that is sort of a status freeze. So the device as it is certified. If you change it, you lose your certification, your allowance to operate it. Okay. If I want to update it, I need to change it to be compliant for some cybersecurity regulations.
Right.
There we go. Now it's a catch-22, so to say. And if it is also kind of complicated by a cultural difference. I mean, I think Emily indicated that about that. And I mean, in industrial environments, in healthcare environments, there is that machinery is there for 15, 20, 25 years. And working is the important notion. It is working. It is still working. And if you compare that to the mindsets in IT, where the idea of software and hardware life cycles is in the range of 36 months or even sprints. Scrum, whatever.
Oh yeah.
I guess that can be called a clash of culture. Right. The change in mindset when all digitalization effort comes into play, that availability in that physical notion of does it still operate, I guess will be augmented by confidentiality of process data of, or the integrity of control data, as in the old mouse case. Mm-hmm. And in the same way, coming back to that compliance versus compliance thing, this whole redo thing of other certifications it is a point where you have that notion of safety and security in the operational world. And the fun part from a language perspective is safety and security are both translated into German like Sicherheit, which makes it easier for us to overcome that cultural difference. Mm-hmm. But safety and security, in order to say, okay, if I do operate a laptop, will I get a power strike or something like that? So it's mm-hmm. safe to operate. Yep. Is it secure? Different question. For the operational technology for industrial systems, having 100 days of no incidents, no accidents since 999 days, all these
right.
signs and billboards we have seen in the movies.
Yes.
Where any kind of weird guy come in, broke his leg, and then we one day
back to zero again.
Sort of things. And changing this, changing the overall cooperation between safety and security, though that they are not conflicting each other, that is a probably a logistic hurdle, I guess, but it's also some of the things where the mindsets. You see that I'm talking lots about mindsets. Have to come together, because if we don't understand the other mindset, if we don't put ourselves in the other shoes on the other side of the table, we're not going to overcome that hurdle.
Yeah.
The other issue. Now, as you mentioned, productions are there for 24/7. So you have a single plant maintenance window in a year. How do I do that? Even if I am able to update a system, if I can only do it once in a year because of other requirements, difficult.
Yes. Yeah.
And so, lots of individual difficulties, but overall, it is that notion of we getting the two concepts together. I mean, we all know that OT is sensitive to the usual approach of cybersecurity. Yeah.
Right.
Scan a water treatment facility with a vulnerability scanner, and I would be cautious about the outcome.
So let's sort of work backwards from a place of an ideal solution. You know, we're never going to get exactly what we want, but it can be helpful to sort of think from a best case scenario. So like fast forward a year, two, 10, whatever, and somehow the country's, healthcare security network is the envy of the world and as impenetrable as it could possibly be. And it's up to date and it's compliant. Like, how did we get there? What massive changes had to happen to get us to that point? You mentioned mindset change, obviously, but like what kind of resource spending, human collaboration had to materialize to get us to the place that we want to be?
My role model is cyber resilience here. I mean, that is starting from a collaboration point of view between the stakeholders, that the two mindsets, the two sides of safety and security. And it might be also about spending and resources, but we're not talking about a complete revamp of things. Maybe over time, things have to be renewed. Yes. I mean, even sometimes 20 years are gone. So there is a new machinery coming in. But on the onset, if I know about what is on the other side, what is in the mindsets, how are things operated from their perspective, and what kind of flexibility is there, then I can change my approach to cybersecurity a bit, and then we overcome these hurdles where most of the time people see that contradiction between safety and security. No?
Yeah. Yeah. Now, I almost am sort of imagining a job role in my mind. Maybe it doesn't exist, but some sort of a sort of gentle cyber mediary, like someone who's like very adept at sort of holding the hands of these sort of administrators and without making them feel, you know, like a dum-dum or like that they've, you know, been sitting on a problem for 20 years without thinking about it. Like, it, you know, we always talk about how cybersecurity, like the sort of hidden superpower is you need soft skills and you need communication skills and the ability. But it seems like here that there would be a special ability to have, if you could have someone who could just go from hospital to hospital, network to network, and like very, you know, without sort of judgment or without, you know, just explain to them, this has to happen. We need to do this. You need to make even the smallest changes to sort of, and how are we going to do this? And how do we sort of like, you know, get you prepared for this big, scary changeover? I mean, you know, what do you think?
Well, I agree to that 100%. Yeah. I mean, I've written about it in the recent weeks, that there is a good likelihood that we will have these two breeds of cybersecurity pros. That is the one guy who is able to talk about it, the one person who is able to mediate between the worlds, as he or she has a good understanding of both the worlds and is able to familiarize with the other side of the table, with the other side of how processes are seen. And the other breed is the folks who are going deep into a system, who are actually trying to figure out how bits and pieces fall together, who do these forensic investigations and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, yeah, it is a situation where you will always start by listening and not by educating. Okay. If someone is coming to me, I'm first listening to you. How do you do it now and why? Yeah. And there might be good reasons for them to do it, why they are doing it in the way now. But then you're asking, and what would happen if you change that? Where are your flexibilities so that you can adjust things, that you can do things in a different way by maintaining operability and increasing security?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, I want to sort of use that as a pivot point to talk about the sort of work of this, the cyber work, if you will. We have a lot of cybersecurity students and aspirants and novice professionals who listen to the show. If they are interested in steering their skill sets towards the goal of these sorts of things, protecting ICS or healthcare systems or legacy, you know, patching legacy systems or other crucial networks that are currently underserved, what are some skills that they should be learning or tasks they should be working on their own to show that they have what it takes to do this kind of work? Are there types of information they should be passionate about learning or exploring to become good at this?
Well, it comes back to what I've stated about myself in the first place. It's know your trade. I mean, yes, you have to have a good understanding, a sound knowledge about cybersecurity, about information technology. Yeah. But being, let's say, the perfect guy in artificial intelligence and machine learning, and coming in with there, I can program a system to digest tons of security events. That doesn't help you to understand the data from a human point of view. If you are not familiar with what is behind the data, what is that actuator doing with a setting? What is the sensor delivering to my industrial control system, to my SCADA system, to my HMI? How do I make sense of these things from a process point of view, from a business process point of view, but also from an operational point of view, so that it's not only a massive amount of data which is digested by an AI system and all of a sudden the AI system tells you you're making rubber boots and instead of doing some chemical stuff, I don't know, just kidding here.
Yeah, right.
And it is that notion of go to the other side. If you are interested in cybersecurity, have your general knowledge ready. Have it ready in terms of, you know, networking, you know, TCP IP, you know how to differentiate between simple terms, IDS, firewall, AV, vulnerability management, change control, and all these things. But you also should be able to provide context.
Yes.
Yeah. If it's not the case for you to do context, this sort of mediation between the worlds,
yeah,
and the willingness to learn new worlds in the one hand side, which is okay, don't get me wrong, is the other part is dig deep.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Go into the analytics of how do I get into attack vectors? How do I do my forensics? How can I analyze, reverse engineer attacks? How can I find out what is going on a specific device? Two sides, two far ends of the whole spectrum of cybersecurity. But that would be sort of where you can navigate in between. Huh? Okay.
Now, as we, this has been a great talk, and you know, although pretty scary, also I think very hopeful in certain ways. Is as we have, you know, we've sort of shown our listeners ways that they can actively, you know, contribute to, in, I would say, to almost sort of the betterment of society in certain ways if they would want to get involved with this kind of work. But can you talk a little bit about, you know, you mentioned in your report that a number of countries took the lessons to heart and secured their systems. I mean, do you have any sort of predictions? You know, sometimes you have a family member, it's like, I don't want to do this thing. And then you beg them and they say, no. And then they sort of, after they get over their initials, maybe embarrassment or whatever, they do the thing. Now, do you have a sense of whether or not some of these people who maybe resisted before are kind of secretly taking care of this business? Do you see this resistance continuing until something, you know, a worst case scenario happens? Like, where do you see this happen, you know, going in the next 5 years?
I think in all fairness, it's a matter of geography. We do see more and more, on the one hand side, regulation, more and more understanding of the issue in broader terms. Stories are highlighted in not only in our space in terms of podcast as we do one, or Brian Krebs or whoever is talking about it. What we also see it in the headline news, that there is an issue and there is something to know about it. And once we are moving away from that sensationalism about it, in going deeper into saying, why does it happen? How do we change that and be more solution oriented than to, hey, there is a fire burning, we have to report about it, way of doing it. I think that will help to change things, that will help to take away the fear of anything I do wrong.
Yes.
Sometimes, sure. Never touch a running system, so to speak. And on the other hand, speaking about geography, I think knowledge, education is also a big deal here. It's hard to say that, as I would love to change it, but if I'm talking about countries like the US, like Canada, like the main European countries, in comparison to other countries where we have seen these massive amounts of system being unprotected, I'm not sure whether we have that same amount of knowledge and understanding to start from.
Okay.
Simple as it is. And it feels sad to say that, I have to admit.
Yeah. Sometimes you have to start from, you know, the painful truth, though.
In all fairness, I'm happy to be proven wrong here.
Yes, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. So as so we wrap up today, and on a triumphant note there. But yeah, so this has been a great conversation, and it's, I think it's given us a lot to think about. And thank you very much for your time. But as we wrap up, can you tell us a bit about your work with NewNet Technologies? What types of projects are you working on for this year, and what are some upcoming things that you're excited about?
Sure. With pleasure.
Yeah.
So NNT, what we do is one of the we tackle one of these basic elements, the essentials of what is there that initiates a what is the root cause of a cybersecurity incident, and that is something is changing. It's a configuration setting. It is a file being dropped. It is someone sending you an email, you click on that, and something happens. Something changes on your device. And that's the simple Office IT explanation of it.
Right.
And to monitor these changes, to be able to contextualize these changes. I mean, we can already monitor the changes, but the ability to contextualize them, to put them into a relation of what is going on the machine, where is that machine, what kind of function is provided by the machine in a business context. These are the things we're working on, whether it is in the cloud, in virtualized environment, whether we were talking about ladder logic on a PLC, everywhere can be a change that can be good, that can be expected, that can be sort of initiated internally due to normal operation, but it can also be malicious. And for us to be able to distinguish between good and bad change and to highlight those who are bad, to make sure that readily available is the information about what is that change? Who has initiated? Where does it come from? What does it mean? Where's the context of it? What is the role of the device? That is what I'm sort of doing in my daily work now with NNT, next to talking to nice hosts.
Oh, you're very kind. So let's wrap up on that. Last question for all the marbles of our listeners want to learn more about Dirk Schrader or NNT. Where can they go online?
www.newnettechnologies.com or use the short version of it, nntws.com.
All right. Thank you, Dirk. Thank you so much for sharing your time and insights today. This was incredibly illuminating and a lot of fun.
Thank you.
All right. And thank you, as always, to everyone at home or at work for listening and watching. New episodes of the CyberWork podcast are available every Monday at 1 p.m. Central, both on video at our YouTube page and on audio wherever fine podcasts are downloaded. You can also find it at www.infoseginstitute.com/podcasts to check out all past episodes. Also, don't forget to check out our hands-on training series, CyberWork Applied. Tune in as expert InfoSec instructors teach you a new cybersecurity skill and show you how that skill applies to real-world scenarios. Go to infoseginstitute.com/learn to stay up to date on all things CyberWork. Thank you once again to Dirk Schrader, and thank you, as always, to everyone for listening and watching. We will speak to you next week. How about some free cybersecurity training resources for you and your team? Just go to infoseginstitute.com/free to get ebooks, training guides, and more than 100 cybersecurity training courses, all free for CyberWork listeners. Go to infoseginstitute.com/free and start learning crucial new skills today.